This is Dr. Michio Kaku, and this is a special edition of Exploration. Today, we're going to talk about something that's been on the minds of billions of people, and that is a tragedy called the coronavirus epidemic. Now, let me be clear about one point, and that is I am not a doctor. I do not have an MD degree. However, I do have a PhD in theoretical physics. And I'm very familiar with the computer modeling that's being done right now, modeling that seems to indicate that we're very close to reaching the apex within 2 to 4 weeks, and we expect that perhaps 100,000 or up to maybe 240,000 Americans may perish just within the next few weeks. And so in this hour of exploration, we're going to talk about the science, not the therapies, not the day-to-day affairs of the coronavirus and the first responders, but the science behind the coronavirus. Now, one question that I often get on the Internet is, well, where did this thing come from? I mean, just a month ago, it was considered a blip on the radar screen, and now we're on lockdown over most of the country. The economy is in free fall. In fact, the entire world seems to be on lockdown just within the last month or 2 months. And the question is, where did it come from? And can it happen again? Well, first of all, we have to understand, where do diseases come from anyway? Roughly 60% or so of all diseases come from animals. That's right, animals. Because you figure that humans have only been around for 100,000, maybe 200,000 years, tops. But animals have been around for tens of millions of years, predating humans by a tremendous amount. Now, what's different? What's different about this is that because of modern technology, humans are expanding. Human settlements are now encroaching upon the ancient world of diseases. It turns out that many of the diseases we're going to talk about today are very old, ancient diseases, diseases that are much older than the human race. But for the most part, they infect just other animals. And these animals, in turn, eventually develop an immunity to these things over millions of years. And then two things happen. One, humans expand into their backyard. That's right, we are the invaders. We're the ones invading into the territory inhabited by these ancient diseases for millions of years. And two, a mutation occurs. A mutant germ jumps out that can infect not just other animals, but humans as well. Now, how do we know this? I mean, after all, this happens over centuries, the millennia. We know this because we can analyze the genetics now of these diseases. Take a look at the flu. Everyone's talking about the flu and comparing it with the coronavirus. But let's take a look at the flu. Where did the flu come from? We have many varieties. We have the Hong Kong flu, the Shanghai flu, the Beijing flu. And what you notice is that most of the flu viruses come from Asia. And if you then DNA sequence the RNA within the genome of these viruses, you find something interesting. For the most part, they come from birds. It is bird genetic material that is found in most of these flu viruses, with some genetic material from pigs and also some from humans. Now, why is that? You see, in Asia, there's something called polyfarming. Polyfarming is found not just in China, but throughout Asia, where peasants live in very close proximity to birds and pigs, especially ducks. And a lot of the flu influenza genetics comes from birds and ducks. The pigs, in turn, eat the bird droppings, and we eat the pigs. And the pigs act like a mixing bowl of genetic material from birds, pigs, and some from humans. And so we realize that, once again, two factors lead to the development of these diseases. One, humans expand into the territory occupied by ancient animals, encountering diseases that are quite ancient. And second of all, mutations occur. mutations occur which allow them to jump from animals to humans. In fact, there's one theory that says even HIV is a product of this transmutation. You see, if you look at the genetics of HIV, you realize that it is pretty new, but is part of a branch of an ancient disease called SIV. S for simian. That is, we're talking about monkeys and apes now. It's a very ancient disease. It's a disease which afflicted apes for millions of years, but eventually they develop immunity to it. Then human settlements start to encroach upon the territory of these apes. Humans eat the apes. They trade in ape meat. And as a consequence, one day, a mutation occurs. At least this is one theory that seems to correspond with the history of HIV and the genetic history of SIV. And then we can now answer the question, can it happen again? Well, the answer is obviously yes, it can happen again, because humans keep on expanding into the territory of these ancient viruses. Mutations occur. Of course, they don't occur all the time, but it takes some time, a few decades, to get a mutation that will make this virus hop from animals into humans, and there we go again. In other words, believe it or not, it's going to happen again. Now, take a look at what our grandparents had to go through in 1918. We forget that in 1918, we had something that killed more humans than World War I. That's right. This is the greatest killer in the history of the human race, and it is the Spanish flu virus. Believe it or not, it killed more humans than all of World War I. In fact, it was so devastating that it actually forced some of the countries involved in World War I to settle before the death became debilitating for the future of their countries. And so we see that throughout history, in fact, I'll mention this a little bit more later, throughout history, human history has in fact been shaped by plagues, black plagues. We forget this because we have modern medicine. We think that plagues are something that you read about in ancient history books, and then you realize, no, they're still there, because animals still have these viruses. And then another question is, well, we talked about the flu. So then the question is, well, what is the difference between the flu and the coronavirus? I mean, aren't some flu viruses coronaviruses? Aren't they related to each other? And the answer is yes, but something caught scientists by surprise. When this thing originally happened, people thought it was similar to the flu, just like we had the Hong Kong flu, Shanghai flu, and whatever. So no big deal. But this is a different kind of animal. First of all, what kills you when you come down with the coronavirus? Now, believe it or not, the coronavirus itself does not kill you. I mean, after all, it's a molecule. It's not even alive. You can't even see it. So what actually kills you? Well, with the 1918 Spanish flu virus, we've actually sequenced it. Scientists went to the North Polar regions, dug up the bodies of people that died because of the 1918 flu, extracted enough genetic material to sequence it. In fact, on your cell phone, you can actually download the entire genome of the greatest killer in the history of the human race, the 1918 Spanish flu virus. And what they found was, well, why did it kill so rapidly? And why did it kill so many young people, unlike the coronavirus? Well, scientists were shocked to find that, well, first of all, of course, the virus itself did not kill you. It's a molecule. You can't even see this thing. But what happens is it stimulated the immune system to go into overdrive. And the immune system creates mucus and different kinds of fluids trying to kill the virus, and you drown. You drown in your own bodily fluids. In fact, that's one of the reasons why pneumonia kills you. Same thing there. The germs, they don't kill you directly, but in this case, it overstimulates the body's immune system to produce fluids and antibodies in a desperate attempt to kill the germs, and you literally drown in your fluids. And they found that the coronavirus is somewhat similar. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in another moment. So why is this spreading so fast, and how dangerous is it compared to the flu virus? Well, we now have some numbers to work with. When you see all these numbers on TV, you go blind. You go blind. What do these numbers mean? What numbers do I trust? The only number that I trust, when I see all these numbers flashed on the screen, the only number that I trust is the death count. Now, why is that? Because you don't really know how many people are afflicted by the virus. You don't know that. Many people are asymptomatic. They have no symptoms at all. They don't even know they're carriers of the germ. So what do you trust? Well, when you die, it's obvious you're dead. You know the symptoms associated with the death of somebody afflicted with coronavirus. So that number is reliable. Take that number and multiply by 100. And that gives you more or less the total spread of the virus, because it kills 1% of those afflicted. So once again, when you see all these numbers on the table, on your TV screen, look at the number of deaths multiplied by 100, and then you know more or less how many people are really, really afflicted by this thing. And then the question is, well, naturally, what are you going to do about it? Do you wear a mask or not? And why is it spreading so rapidly? Well, we have some more numbers coming in which are not very good. We now realize that roughly 25% of people who have no symptoms at all, they're perfectly healthy, but they're carriers. They're carriers. They're afflicted with the coronavirus. 25% of these people can be asymptomatic, carriers of the virus with no symptoms, and then spread it. And so you may invite somebody for dinner. He looks great, looks healthy, healthy as a horse, and then he's actually a spreader of the disease. In other words, you don't have to cough or sneeze to spread the germs. That means that, well, we're looking at masks again. Now, when you go to Asia, the first thing you realize in Asia is there's no stigma about putting on a mask. It's very common in Japan, very common throughout Asia, so there's no social stigma, and so people put on masks. And they think, scientists think, that that's probably one of several reasons why South Korea has been able to more or less control the spread of this virus, because everybody has a face mask on. And so the government now is rethinking whether or not it should allow ordinary people to put on face masks, because of the fact that, like I said, 25% of those people that have the virus are asymptomatic, and you don't even know they have it. Plus the fact that when you sneeze, well, there's one report from MIT showing that some of the virus can go out to, well, what, about 20 feet. And so you realize that when you go to a hospital and you check the air, just check the air. The air should be clean, because according to conventional wisdom, all the droplets go to the floor. But when you check the air, you find there's some suspension of aerosols of the virus outside the hotel, outside the hospital room. So we realize that the virus is, first of all, 10 to 20 times more deadly than flu, and is much more easy to catch as a consequence. And then the next question that I get is, well, did somebody create this virus? Was it bioengineered by some nefarious think tank someplace? Was it weaponized? Well, we have a partial answer to this question, because scientists have now picked apart the genome of the coronavirus, which was given to the West by Chinese scientists. First of all, why is it called coronavirus? Well, corona is the luminous halo that you find around the sun. That's called the corona of the sun. And if you take a look at the coronavirus, it looks like the halo of the sun, except you have spikes coming out. These spikes are called protein spikes. Very important. The protein spikes are like grappling hooks. They allow the virus to latch onto a docking site of your cells in your nose and your throat, and then two genes are activated. One gene in the protein spike basically latches on like a docking maneuver, latches on to a docking site of your cell. That's when you get infected. But there's a second gene. A second gene we now know is like a can opener. It rips open the cell wall and then injects its own genetic material into the cell, hijacking the cell's reproductive mechanism to create hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of itself. And then when the cell wall busts open, you have not just one virus, you have hundreds of viruses. And so you can see this exponential rise, starting with one coronavirus. You have, let's say, 100, then 100 times 100, 100 times 100 times 100. And before you know it, you've infected a good fraction of the human race. Now, what did the scientists find looking for evidence of bioengineering and weaponization? Was there a conspiracy to create this thing? Well, probably not. I mean, you can't dismiss it entirely. But when you look at these mutations, especially the mutations in the protein spikes, you realize that they are not simple derivatives of known coronaviruses. That is, if you were a nefarious scientist working for some evil empire wanting to create a weaponized germ, you would take an existing germ and tweak it a bit. These are very complicated pieces of organic machinery. However, when you look at this virus, it is very different, quite different from an ordinary virus that's been tweaked in order to weaponize it. And so that's why scientists are saying, well, probably not, that somebody who wanted to weaponize a virus, that's not what they would have done. They would have taken a known virus, simply tweaked it a bit in order to get fast results. However, this virus is rather sophisticated. Several mutations have gone into it to make it so deadly. And so, in other words, probably it was natural selection. It was evolution that created this virus. And then the next question that I get is, what about the good news and the bad news? Is it all bad news? Well, the bad news, you've heard, the bad news is quite bad, and that is we're headed into what is called the surge. That is, we're going to see this exponential rise just in the next few weeks, this rise in the total number of deaths. Now, how do we know that? Because these people who are going to die in the surge, they're already infected. They already have the virus growing in their body. And so we can then begin to use estimates of what we think the population of the infected population of infected humans is, and then extrapolate 2 weeks into the future. And what we find is, yes, there's going to be a surge in the coming weeks. Now, there's one piece of evidence that is new that is quite interesting. There's a company called Kinsa, which makes thermometers, electronic thermometers. And when you record your temperature, you send it on the internet. Well, Kinsa now has this huge database of temperatures throughout the United States and when they were recorded, how much they were. And what they found was fascinating. They found that when the fever starts to peak in a certain region, they realize the virus is spreading, but you won't see the effects of it for a few more weeks. A few weeks later, bingo, people go to the hospital and you see that. You see that in the hospitalization rate. So in some sense, you can sort of predict the future of prediction. That is, even before you see a spike in the amount of hospitalizations, you can see the rise in the fever rate even before then. And what they found was interesting. They found that all parts of the United States, except two places, all parts of the United States, we see a gradual dampening, a dampening of the number of fevers and the time between people being exposed to the virus. That's a little piece of good news. And 2 weeks later, that's reflected in the data. And sure enough, if you look at the New York data, you realize that last week we were doubling the number of hospitalizations every 2 days. Every 2 days, the number of hospitalizations doubled. That's the beginning of the surge. Then it went into every doubling time, it took 3 days, then 4 days and 6 days. So that's a good sign. We're still seeing the surge. We're still growing exponentially. There's still something called a doubling time for the number of hospitalizations. But the distance between hospitalizations has increased. So that's a little bit of good news in this ocean of bad news. And now let me say something else about history. We tend to think that everything that happens to us happened for the first time. As somebody once said, every generation thinks they invented sex first. Well, our generation thinks that we invented the plague first. Except when you go through history, you realize that plagues were the norm. Actually, the norm throughout history. Once in a generation, people naturally assume there would be some kind of pestilence, some kind of black plague. The Bible mentions it. And it's just part of nature. It's God's wrath against the sins of humanity. But if you take a look at some of these ancient plagues, you learn some lessons. And some good, believe it or not, some good actually came out of some of these plagues of the past. For example, the plague of 1350, we're talking about centuries ago, the plague of 1350 affected Italy really hard. In fact, something like 50% of the population of parts of Europe eventually came down and died because of the plague of 1350. But there was one gentleman by the name of Boccaccio. He was a writer. He collected stories. And so he wrote a novel called The Decameron, representing 10 stories or 10 days. A group of people decided to go into the countryside. They wanted to leave the pestilence-ridden city. They didn't know much about the science of germs, but they knew that the cities were breeding grounds for the germ. So they went into the countryside. All these people then had nothing to do. So they decided to tell a story a day. Every day, somebody would tell a story, an amusing story about a certain topic. Well, after 100 days, there were 100 stories. Boccaccio then summarizes them into a book called The Decameron, which is a masterpiece. In fact, I read it when I was in college as part of my reading list. And many people centuries later would read it and copy many of the stories because they're so good. In fact, one of the people who copied many of these stories was a man named William Shakespeare. A lot of Shakespearean plots come out of this book. So if you want to read something when you are holed up in your house because you are under social isolation, get a copy of the Decameron, representing the number 100, by Boccaccio, because it'll definitely keep you up at night. Then there was the plague of 1666. For science, that was a very important plague, because that plague of 1666 shut down Cambridge University. And there was a young 23-year-old student who had to go home. He was sent back because, of course, Cambridge was being ravaged by the plague. Well, he went home to his estate in Woolsthorpe, and one day he was walking on his estate, and he saw an apple fall. And then, according to legend, he said to himself, if an apple falls, then does the moon also fall? And then he had one of the greatest insights in the history of the human race. He realized that the moon does fall. It's continually falling toward the earth. It doesn't hit the earth because the earth is round. It goes around the earth. But it spins around the earth like a satellite. And then he quickly realized that he could write the equations for this, but you couldn't solve the equations. The mathematics of 1666 are so primitive, he could not solve his own equations. So he decided to invent a new mathematics called calculus. Well, that theory that he came up with was the theory of gravity. The mathematics he discovered was called calculus, and the young man was Isaac Newton. perhaps the greatest scientist in all of human history. The man who set into motion mechanics, the man who set into motion the machine age, the man who made possible locomotives and factories and the Industrial Revolution, all of that because the plague of 1666 shut down Cambridge University and he had nothing to do. Well, what I'd like to do now is take some listener phone calls. That's right. If you want to get on Exploration, get a piece of paper and write this number down. 212-209-2877. Once again, 212-209-2877. And maybe you can get on Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, and every week, Exploration is on WBAI, and in fact, it's been on WBAI for several decades, and I'd be more than happy to take some phone calls if you call 212-209-2877. And once again, I'm not a doctor. I cannot give you medical advice about what to do if you have the coronavirus. I'm a physicist. However, I'm very familiar with modeling. I'm very familiar with the way in which scientists make estimates of what may happen into the future. And so once again, the number to call, if you want to get on Exploration and ask me a question, the number to call is 212-209-2877. So how are we doing? Do we have many calls coming in yet?
None at the moment. I believe we may have Linda Perry standing by, however.
Okay.
Yes, hi. I'm so glad to hear you on the radio, Michio. It's been many years since I spoke to you, and I'm just so glad that you're here live on WBAI explaining a lot of what we're experiencing now. I'm curious. You were talking about the number of deaths, and you were saying that one needs to multiply them by 100 to just kind of figure out how this is going to go, how it's panning out. So what does that mean exactly? Because so far in New York, we have 1,940 deaths. So are you saying that we're going to have 194,000 deaths in New York?
No. What I'm saying is the death rate, the fatality rate of the virus is 1%.
Okay.
Therefore, of all the numbers that come at you, you can't trust any of them except the death rate, because it's very difficult to hide a dead body. It's very difficult to find somebody who is asymptomatic, but if somebody dies, you know he died. So with the 1% mortality rate, you take the number of deaths, multiply by 100, and that gives you a rough estimate of how many people are really infected. And if you do this simple test, you realize that most countries...
I see.
By the way...
they're lying through their teeth, or their numbers are completely wrong.
The phones have exploded here. We have five people on hold and four more trying to call in.
I just have another question, because I was so fascinated by how you were describing this virus, because we're all seeing those pictures, you know, with these sort of these cones sticking up out of this very nice looking corona, I guess. And can you just explain that a little bit more, how it grips the body?
Right. What is a virus? A virus is a piece of RNA, or maybe a little bit of DNA, surrounded by a protein shell. And on the protein shell, there are spikes, usually, of some sort. These spikes are docking sites. They allow the virus to latch onto one of your cells. They cut open your cell, and then they inject their genetic material into your cell, hijacking the cell's reproductive machinery to create hundreds of copies of itself, and then the cell splits open, releasing hundreds of copies of the virus. So very rapidly, from just one virus, you're sneezing within just a few days. So it's just a molecule. One molecule can make you sneeze in just a few days, because every time it reproduces, it makes perhaps 100 or so copies of itself. And the shape of the virus is key to how it infects you. So those protein spikes is the reason why it's so deadly, because it very easily latches onto the docking sites of your cell and hijacks the genetic machinery of your cell.
And you're saying that the molecule, it's not what kills you. What kills you is your immune system going into overdrive. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, when you take a look at pneumonia, you realize it is caused by a germ, a bacteria, but it's a germ. You know, you can squash it with your fingers, and you realize, how can something like that kill you? And part of the reason is that it stimulates your immune system, and you can't breathe. That's why you have to have oxygen. That's why people are saying you need two things if you go to the hospital and you're in very bad shape. One is a ventilator to force oxygen into your lungs, and then oxygen itself to make sure you get an adequate supply of oxygen, because your cells are flooded. Your cells are flooded by your immune system overreacting. That's why, by the way, some of the drugs that are being tested are anti-inflammatory drugs. That's why some of these drugs being tested right now, even though we don't know they work or not, are anti-inflammatory drugs, because they suppress the overactive immune system. And so the reason why the flu of 1918 killed so many people is because they drowned. They drowned in their own bodily fluids. And that's why it was so lethal, because it was a very efficient killer. It basically elicited a tremendous back reaction from your own immune system, and you literally drowned in your own fluids.
WBAI, you're on the air with Michio Kaku. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hello. excuse me. Dr. Michio Kaku, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I find it fascinating what you described about how the virus is working, as well as positive things that have come out of other plagues. What I would like to know is what you see as a result a year from now and 5 years from now, because this Pandora's box has been opened and no one seems to be speaking to that. I mean, for obvious reasons, of course, we have economic collapse as well as the surge that we're expecting, but we're not only in danger now. I'd like to know if you can explain, I know you're not a medical doctor, but do you have any, anecdotes about whether or not there is damage to the lungs that people who have been affected with this, are they in danger of getting the flu again? Will they have bouts of severe episodes in their lives? And also, I understand the arguments for and against masks. I don't practice as a nurse, but I did graduate from nursing school, and I also did a paper as a teenager about cancers being, caused by viruses. So I've studied a bit of this, and I've been reading a lot. What I'd like to know is how people who, I think that 90% of the global population will be affected. I'd like to know how people can, is it possible for people to protect themselves? And like I said, I think...
And what it looks like down the line. You just want to know what it looks like down the line. Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you for the question.
Okay, let me try to tackle some of the parts of your question one by one. First of all, what's going to happen in the future? Well, the modelers say the following, that we're hitting the surge now. We're going to see this exponential doubling every few days. But don't be frightened, because the people who are dying now are already infected today. So they're just not dying yet, and they will die as the surge starts to rise. And then the hump, the apex or the peak, we will be hitting the hump probably in late April. And then it's going to go down over summer if it's seasonal. We're not positive, but we think it is seasonal. It's going to go down, and then it'll start to rise a little bit come winter time. And then hopefully by next year, we'll have
a vaccine. Whoa, next year? Seriously?
Next year, right. The reason why it takes so long to create a vaccine is that first you have to prove that it's effective, that it even works at all. And second, you have to prove that it's harmless. And third, you have to show that it's universal, that it works for every race, every country, every group, every gender, every population. So there are three stages that you have to go through before you market a virus to billions, billions of people on the planet Earth. You don't want to make a mistake. One mistake and you've disinfected several billion people with the wrong serum. So you want to make sure that it's good. So by next year, okay, hopefully we'll have a control over this. And as a consequence, we'll hope to have a vaccine by next year. And then it'll be just like the flu. That is, every year people will get it, but people will be vaccinated. It'll be a nuisance, but it'll still be around. Just like the Hong Kong flu and the Shanghai flu, they're still around, but they're harmless because we get vaccinated by them. But it does mean that even for months into the future, we have to be very careful. Now, the other therapy that looks very promising is antibody therapy, which is over 100 years old. And that is, you take the antibodies of somebody who survived the virus, extract out the antibodies, and then inject these good antibodies into somebody who's very sick. That's still experimental, but that's also very promising. Mm-hmm. And there are also 80 other experimental things that are being looked at. One of them, for example, is anti-inflammatory, because one of the reasons why the virus kills you is because it overexcites your immune system. So why not try to dampen your immune system down a little bit? So there are many avenues, but unfortunately, none of them are ready yet. And so we're in the situation where we have to practice social distancing. We have to wash our hands. We have to make sure that we cough in our sleeves and maybe wear masks. That's still a big question mark. But it does mean that this will be around till next year.
So I wonder about polyforming, though, because polyforming will continue. So won't other viruses perhaps come out of this?
Yeah, there's been some talk that maybe Chinese farming and exotic animal markets should be closed down because it's simply too dangerous.
Yeah, this is WBAI in New York. You're listening to Michio Kaku. The program is Explorations here over 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, streaming at WBAI.org. And we are taking phone calls at 212-209-2877. And again, thank you so much for explaining so much of this to us. We really appreciate this, and we appreciate you now being on every Wednesday. If you could possibly come on live some more, we would really love that. So we'll take the next caller. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hi. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm Zabby, and I'm calling from Suffolk County. And
okay.
I want to pick up on the last caller because it's quite interesting. I had not studied and read all about the connection that their viruses could be causing cancer. And so since Michio Kaku did not pick up on that part of her question, I'm going to continue because I had heard that this novel coronavirus was novel because it did use the human being as an incubator, so to speak, to replicate itself. And I know that this is what they say cancer cells do. They replicate themselves all over, and you have metastases or whatever, and it goes all through the body. So, indeed, does the virus, in fact, and this is why we have no cure for cancer after all these years, you know, my parents had heard, oh, there's going to be a cure for cancer, and no, there wasn't. And isn't still, and perhaps, and I heard some cancers being now handled with immunotherapy successfully. I know one woman who praises immunotherapy, but the drugs would have cost her $10,000 a month to get it, to cure leukemia, I think it was. And so luckily she was able to go to the pharmaceutical company and get some kind of scholarship, and so that she didn't have to pay that.
Okay, Zabby, let's see what Michio has to say about this. Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay. Cancer, by the way, is not a mystery. We still have no cure for it, of course, but it's no longer a mystery. We know that at heart, cancer is a genetic disease. It's a disease of your genes, which in turn can be triggered by viruses, by chemicals, by radiation. Many, many things can trigger cancer. Cancer, it turns out, is caused by a combination of four major mutations. Not just one, not two, but four major mutations in the chromosome are enough to set off cancer. That's why it takes so long to get cancer. You don't get cancer immediately if you get a harsh sunburn, for example. You may get a sunburn and 20 years later you have skin cancer right at that spot because the four mutations have to be knocked off one after the other after the other. It takes time, and that's why cancer takes so long. But like I said, almost anything that causes genetic damage can in principle cause cancer, and that's why a cure for cancer is so difficult. We have now encyclopedias of cancer. We realize now that cancer is not just one disease. It's basically broken genes. And how many ways can you break a gene? There are thousands of ways you can break a gene. And so that's one of the reasons why probably we'll always have cancer. I personally think that in the far future, cancer will be like the common cold. We can cure the common cold, except it's simply too expensive because there are 300 different rhinoviruses out there. So it's not profitable for the pharmaceuticals to cure the common cold, even though they can. So I think in the future, the cancer will be somewhat similar to the common cold. We'll just live with it. It's not going to kill anyone in the future, but we'll simply live with it because it just costs too much to cure the thousands of different varieties of cancer. But there's hope. As you mentioned, immunotherapy is one of the big, bright hopes. We used to take cancer and either slice it, zap it, or poison it. That's how we dealt with cancer for 50 years, simply slicing it, zapping it, or poisoning it. Now we can actually strengthen your immune system so your own immune system, the T cells, can attack cancer. Of course, you have to soup up your cells. You have to take T cells from your body, extract it out of your body, modify it with gene therapy, and then put it back into your body. And that's how we have now a fourth way to cure cancer. And as you mentioned, there are some similarities between the coronavirus and cancer, but they are a little bit different. And that is, cancer is nothing but broken genes. Four major mutations in a cancer will cause it to become cancerous. These are your own cells. There's nothing outside. Radiation, heat, chemicals, whatever, cause the cancer to misfire and the genes get corrupted and you get cancer. However, the coronavirus is an outside agent. It's a virus. The virus can also cause cancer, but in this situation, instead, the virus simply hijacks your reproductive machinery and simply floods your body with copies of itself, and the body in this situation overreacts and basically drowns. You wind up drowning in your own fluids. That's why we need ventilators. That's why we need oxygen, because after a while, you can't breathe. You can't breathe. You literally suffocate in your own bodily fluids.
Is it helpful for people to be working on building up their immune system, are not infected?
Yeah, one thing you can always do, and this is the so-called fountain of youth, is to exercise. Now, I know that most people would rather pop a pill rather than exercise, but exercising really does build up your immune system. And people ask, why is it that some people have very mild symptoms and some people have horrendous reaction to the virus? Well, we don't know the answer to that. But one theory is that people have different immune systems. People who live to be 100 years old, for example, they have excellent immune systems. These people hardly ever get sick. And therefore, anything that improves your immune system, like the common cold, increases your T cells, and your T cells in turn are your first line of defense against germs.
Mm-hmm. This is listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. You're listening to Explorations with Michio Kaku, heard on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. The phone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2877 if you have questions or comments. And we'll take the next call on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, Doctor.
Hi. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Anoop, and I'm calling from Jersey City. My question has to do with the strange nature of viruses. You know, I remember learning in school that technically they're not even considered alive. And it makes me think about eras in human history. I mean, not human history, but the the Earth's history, where there were periods of life on Earth, and then cataclysms which wiped it out. And I've heard theories about how some of these molecules were seeded back onto the Earth to start a cycle of life evolving again. And this happened in, like, fits and starts in the early Earth's history. And I was wondering if you could speak about a little bit about that.
Well, believe it or not, even though we think that Mother Nature is warm and cuddly and likes people, we realize that every once in a while Mother Nature has a temper tantrum and obliterates most life on the planet Earth. You realize that at one point the Earth was snowball Earth, completely covered in ice, and that life just barely squeaked through that era when the entire surface of the Earth was covered with ice. You realize that most creatures on the Earth, 99.9% of all species eventually go extinct. Extinction is the norm. If you don't believe me, get a shovel, dig right under your feet right now, and you'll encounter the bones of all the extinct animals that did die, because they're part of the 99.9% that died. Take a look at humanity. 70,000 years ago, by looking at our genes, we know that there was a cataclysm that wiped out most humans. Only a few hundred, maybe 1,000 of us, survived 70,000 years ago. How do we know that? Because all of us are almost clones of each other. You can retrace your heritage by using Ancestry.com and stuff like that. Go back 70,000 years, and you find out that only a handful of people gave birth to the entire human race. Now, what happened 70,000 years ago to kill almost everybody? Well, we think there was a volcano that erupted in Indonesia. This is a theory. It's called a Toba, T-O-B-A, Toba volcano. It was this huge, tremendous volcanic eruption that engulfed most of Africa and killed most life forms in Africa, including our ancestors. And so to answer your question, yes, you're right. Many times in the past, life itself was almost wiped out. And sometimes I think that it was almost a miracle that life did survive all the various cataclysms that existed. At one point, the Earth was completely covered in water. We were water world. Another point, the Earth was completely covered in ice. Before that, the Earth was sort of like the moon, being bombarded by asteroids from outer space. I mean, sometimes I think that it's lucky that we made it alive at all.
Let's take another call. I can't believe you said that Mother Nature had a temper tantrum. Hello? You know, to look at it this way, you wonder. Mm-hmm. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, this is James from Brooklyn. Can you hear me?
Hey, James, we hear you loud and clear.
Dr. Kaku, I take a so-called biologic called Humira for psoriatic arthritis. I've been taking it for several years, twice a month, and I understand it depresses my immune system. So I wonder if that possibly puts me in good stead as far as coming down with the severe symptoms. But the thing is, I couldn't afford it if I didn't have Medicaid. So I wonder if it's as if the virus itself is almost like a market opportunity for certain businesses that would like to charge pharma prices. For instance, the local cable network, where if you don't have Wi-Fi, they'll basically charge you an arm and a leg to get hooked up, and it's a very wobbly price structure. You can count on it going up year by year, if not at the quicker intervals. So it just seems that this social distancing and having ourselves isolated, it's not able to go to the library, access information for free and so forth. I wonder if that plays into their hands. I don't know if you have any thoughts as far as that
Thanks
way.
Thanks for your question, James.
Okay, well, let me take a crack at that. You ask many things. First of all, some people are on immune suppressant drugs because sometimes your immune system is maybe perhaps overactive. And so you want to suppress your immune system. However, there's a price you pay for that. And the price you pay for that is when you initially get attacked by the coronavirus, that's when you do need an immune system to knock out those germs at the very beginning. And so that's why people are saying that if you are on drugs that suppress your immune system, you have to be careful. You have to talk to your doctor because you're more vulnerable to the coronavirus. Now, in the late stages when you're near death and your body is being flooded by the fact that you have an overactive immune system, that's a totally different thing, and that could kill you in the later stages. But in the initial stages, when you're simply first infected, that's when you do want to have a healthy immune system. So it's a trade-off. If you start to take less of your immune-suppressing drugs, then you are more vulnerable to the coronavirus. So before you do anything, I suggest you talk to your physician, because it's a balancing act, you see? Because if you take this medicine, you will suppress your immune system, making you more vulnerable to the coronavirus. So you have to be very careful. It's a fine line. It's a trade-off. You should talk to your doctor about that.
WBAI, you're on the air. We'll take the next caller. Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Okako, Michio.
Hi, can you speak up a little bit?
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Okako.
Sure, yes? Dr. Michio Kaku. What's your name? Where are you calling from, please?
My name is Earl. I'm calling from Montclair, New Jersey.
Okay, Earl, go right ahead.
I was wondering, Doc said that, and you were speaking earlier about 20 minutes ago, to half an hour ago, about the origins of corona, and you said that it in terms of historical viruses, you said it's common and it's from evolution. I was just wondering how that vibes with things like what Gary Null said a few weeks ago, that it's a lab disease. How does the two, are you speaking scientific fact? Is he speaking something else? What's the difference between
that it's
the two?
A what disease? I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Gary Null said this is a produced lab disease, like a form of warfare then. Gary Null said that
okay,
several times. So several other of DAI staff members said the same thing.
Okay,
I'm
well,
just wondering
let's
how that jives with Dr. Okaku.
We have a lot of
evolution.
First of all, the earliest origin of the conspiracy theory is the fact that in Wuhan, just outside Wuhan, there is a virus laboratory. In fact, two of them. So some people are saying, aha, there were two laboratories that were experimenting on horseshoe bats. And horseshoe bats, we think, is the animal that originally created the first virus, which then hopped over to humans via the pangolin animal. That was the origin of the rumor, because why would China have two, not one, but two virus laboratories in just outside the city of Wuhan? But recently, scientists have genetically sequenced, this is new, only just a few days old, sequenced all the genes within the virus. And even though you can't rule it out, it shows that it was not simply a virus which was tweaked, because that's how you would weaponize something. When we weaponize something, we take an object that is known, tweak it a bit, and let it become dangerous. This was a novel virus, not just one, but several. Several genes in a rather ingenious pattern combined to give you something that was very infectious. But like I said, that's not a proof. It's only an indication that it does seem as if it wasn't engineered. It seemed as if it was a byproduct of evolution, because a normal person would not have done these several genetic mutations simultaneously to create this thing. But it's not an absolute proof. In fact, I don't think anyone has a smoking gun. And, of course, the Chinese, one mid-level official in China said that it was the American soldiers who created the virus. So I think that we need simply more investigation of this. But the leading theory right now is that it is rather sophisticated. It's not something that a weaponizer would normally devise. Normally, you would just tweak one or two genes. This was several genes that were tweaked in a rather unorthodox fashion. And that's why we're saying that it looks more like evolution rather than by design. But no one knows for sure.
Thank you so much, Michio Kaku, for this program, for talking with our listeners. We hope to have you back. Can we have you back live again next week?
Okay, next week is fine.
Oh, good, good. Okay, so we will see you again next week, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really need all this information because there's so much false information that's going back and forth. So we so appreciate you.
My pleasure.
This is WBAI in New York. We're going out with Timelessness, Wynton Marsalis with Timelessness.